have a judgment against those who took us into this war in Afghanistan.
Medea Benjamin, Masouda Soltan, thank you so much.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Show your support for cable programming by picking up the special limited edition 2022 Bluegrass Marathon t-shirt. Flaunt your love of bluegrass and KBOO with this stylish royal blue and neon yellow tee. Get yours now at kboo.fm/bgshirt. That is kboo.fm/bgshirt.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an audit of the Portland Police Bureau finds they collected intelligence on residents who weren't suspected of a crime. PSU releases a study showing tiny home villages are an effective alternative for unhoused people. And Phil Knight contributes $750,000 to Betsy Johnson's governor campaign. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 6th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. The Portland Police Bureau collected intelligence on Portlanders' political activity when there was no crime suspected of them. That's according to a new audit of the Bureau's practices, specifically around the 2020 racial justice protests. KBOO's Josh Salem has the details.
An audit of the Portland Police Bureau's intelligence gathering practices found officers collected information about political activity during the 2020 protests without providing evidence any crime had been committed. The city auditor's office also found the police did not limit access to their reports and kept them longer than they are supposed to. The auditors reviewed 40 police reports related to racial justice protests and 33 criminal intelligence unit reports. In five of the police reports, auditors found the police collected personally identifiable information such as political, religious, or social views without documenting criminal activity. One officer recorded protesters with his personal cell phone. He said the video was for his personal use. In other examples, officers took photos of protesters and video of organizers and recorded license plate information and saved photos and videos posted to social media. In six instances, auditors found the criminal intelligence unit kept information about demonstrators without substantiated criminal activity longer than the permitted 30 days. The information was also available throughout the Bureau, despite there being procedures in place that should have limited access. The audit report said any officer from any agency searching the records and using the names would have access to case information. The audit cited studies showing officers view disrespectful people as more dangerous. That could raise risk for the people named in the reports if, as in one example cited by OPB, during a traffic stop, an officer sees a person participated in a Black Lives Matter protest. Portland Police Chief Chuck Lovell responded to the audit, saying a new directive regarding criminal intelligence will address its overall concerns. The Bureau also plans to write policies governing the use of surveillance technology that would include prohibitions on indiscriminate mass surveillance, targeting a person solely on race, ethnicity, and other individual characteristics, harassing people, or using the technology for personal reasons. The Portland audit did not assess any federal law enforcement agencies or their actions in Portland. In July of 2020, the Portland City Council had voted to ban the Police Bureau from communicating with federal law enforcement in our city, responding to racial justice protests. Portland Auditor Mary Hull Caballero told Oregon Public Broadcasting, quote, "They need to have procedures and policies in place that acknowledge that this is a particular area of policing that is sensitive because it has the potential to step on people's rights and stifle free speech," end quote. She did say she is satisfied with the police bureau's response to the audit. In a letter to Hull Caballero, Mayor Ted Wheeler said he would work with the police bureau to enact the audit's recommendations. Wheeler wrote, quote, "I support these protections because of the very real history of shameful and biased surveillance practices by some law enforcement agencies in our state and nation. This history cannot be forgotten as we forge ahead with efforts to improve policing and work to earn trust between law enforcement and our community," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A new study from Portland State University says that tiny home villages are an effective alternative shelter for unhoused people. They studied 6 local tiny home villages and surveyed residents to get a sense of their satisfaction and how the villages are meeting their needs. PSU found a majority of residents are happy where they live, and especially so when they have input on decision-making in the community. The villages studied range from ones that are totally self-run to others that are run by nonprofits or by the city. The study stressed that permanent housing is ultimately the solution for the housing crisis Portland is facing, but that tiny home villages are a good interim solution. One issue the study pointed out was that tiny home village residents were made up in large part by white men, even though an estimated 40% of unhoused Portlanders are Black, Indigenous, or people of color. The study comes out at an important moment when the city of Portland has committed to creating 6 new tiny home villages called Safe Rest Villages, modeled after St. John's Village. Nike founder Phil Knight recently contributed $750,000 to Betsy Johnson's campaign for governor, adding to the $250,000 he'd contributed earlier. Earlier this year, Johnson gave up the Scappoose legislative seat she'd held for 20 years and left the Democratic Party to run as an independent. Unlike the Democratic and Republican candidates for governor, Johnson will face no primary opposition and will appear on the November ballot. She currently has over $5 million in her campaign fund. Johnson told Willamette Week, quote, "Without the money and machinery from the two-party system, I need all the help I can get to rescue Oregon," end quote. In 2018, Knight, the wealthiest person in Oregon, contributed $2.5 million to Republican Newt Bueller's unsuccessful campaign for governor. California climate activists are planning rallies this Friday, April 8th, as a part of a day of climate action. In light of the atrocities committed by Russia, which is dependent on oil and gas sales, they're calling for an end to drilling for fossil fuels in California. Suzanne Potter has more.
Climate activists are calling for a rapid shift away from oil and gas as a way to reduce world dependence on the fossil fuels that prop up the Russian regime and its war in Ukraine. Rallies are set for this Friday in 10 cities across California, from Sacramento to San Diego. Ukrainian immigrant Igor Tregub, chair of the California Democratic Party Environmental Caucus, says the country must stop the importation of any Russian fossil fuels.
We vote with our dollars and no longer rely on authoritarian petrostates that murder citizens of neighboring democratic countries.
Tregub also supports a bill in Congress to punish oil companies that gouge consumers at the gas pump and one that would declare a climate emergency. Rally information is listed on the Last Chance Alliance Facebook page. California will no longer issue fracking permits after 2024, but former San Luis Obispo Mayor Heidi Harmon wants to ban all drilling permits right away, and she wants protections for people who live near drilling operations.
Last October, the Newsom administration proposed a 3,200 feet setback separating new oil drilling from community. So we are asking that this rule be strengthened to include all existing operations.
Opponents cite concerns about the loss of energy sector jobs. California has passed stringent clean car regulations and set a goal of becoming carbon neutral by 2045. But Richmond Vice Mayor Eduardo Martinez says the state still produces and refines a great deal of oil.
We've done too little and not soon enough. If we don't start taking actions to stop climate chaos, we're at the end of our rope. We need to start coming up with a plan for a just transition. It's going to happen, and if we don't plan for it, it's going to happen badly.
For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Ukrainian President Zelensky calls for reforming the UN, and oil companies testify on Capitol Hill about high gas prices. With those stories and more, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We welcome the willingness of the sides to continue engaging to reach a mutual understanding.
Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs at the United Nations, Rosemary DiCarlo, on the deteriorating situation in Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the UN Security Council on Tuesday, calling for reforming the agency's system to better guarantee border recognition and compliance with international law. The reported killings of civilians in the town of Bucha near Kyiv have prompted vows of new sanctions against Russia from both the U.S. and European Union. Oil companies are expected to defend themselves on record-high gas prices at a hearing today on Capitol Hill. But Republicans, including New York Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, are pointing the finger at Biden.
Since Joe Biden's inauguration day, energy prices have skyrocketed by 81%. Nearly a quarter of Americans reduced or went without basic food and medicine so that they could pay their energy bill in the last 12 months.
Republicans also are voicing disapproval over the administration's recent decision to end Title 42, which allowed migrants at the border to be expelled instead of being processed in the U.S. under immigration rules. Ranking Republican on the House Oversight and Reform Subcommittee, Wisconsin Representative Green Grothman said the policy will worsen the number of people who stay in the country illegally, what he calls gotaways.
The Border Patrol is now double that, and they estimate that in March, instead of 30,000, we have about 60,000 gotaways coming in the country, which is, I think, is what happens when you don't have enough people guarding the border.
Former President Barack Obama made his first White House appearance since leaving office, joining President Joe Biden yesterday to celebrate the passage of the Affordable Care Act.
31 million people now have health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. 4 out of 5 Americans can find quality coverage for under $10 a month.
Biden also announced a new proposed rule change to the ACA that would increase the number of dependents eligible for coverage to fix what's been called the family glitch. The Biden administration is expected to announce another extension to the student loan pause this week. The move would extend the moratorium on federal student loan payments and interest accrual past the current May 1st expiration date. North Carolina Democratic Congresswoman Deborah Ross.
The burden of crippling student loan debt, with higher interest rates, with not enough affordable housing, all of these things are coming together as a perfect storm for the next generation.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Shanghai's entire population of 26 million is currently under lockdown due to COVID. Today, Shanghai, China's largest city, announced another daily record high of over 16,000 cases. That's low by international standards, but it's the country's worst outbreak of the pandemic. The lockdown of China's financial powerhouse threatens to devastate the country's economy and worsen already fragile global supply chains. A separate outbreak continues to rage in the northeastern province of Jilin, while in Beijing, an entire shopping center was shut down when a case of COVID was detected there. Christian Roloffs is the chief executive of Hamburg-based logistics company Container Exchange. He said, quote, COVID-induced lockdowns in China and the Russia-Ukraine war has torn apart the expectations of recovery of the supply chain, which has been grappling to keep up with the pressures of implications resulting from these and many other disruptions. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Street Roots investigative reporter Piper McDaniel about the paper's ambitious new project tackling renters' rights. Stick around at 6, it's Rhythm Nation with Peter Marks, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 49. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a whopping high of 75 degrees. Today in history, in 1896, the first modern Olympic Games was held in Athens, Greece, since being banned by Roman Emperor Theodosius 1,500 years earlier. The quote of the day is from American gymnast and 3-time gold medalist Gabby Douglas, who said, quote, Are you going to stand there or are you going to crumble? In the face of everything, stand still. Radiation Compensation Exposure Act offered benefits to some Navajo Nation residents who were sickened by radiation exposure during the Cold War. Leaders are asking Congress to extend the benefits since the act expires this summer. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Navajo Nation leaders are pressing members of Congress to reauthorize and expand benefits for Western residents sickened by radiation exposure during the Cold War. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, the Radiation Compensation Exposure Act is set to expire in July.
Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez met with several members of Congress in Washington, D.C. last week to advocate for the law known as RECA. It was enacted in 1990 and provides compensation for people called downwinders who've experienced health problems as a result of past nuclear detonations and working in the uranium industry. A bill was introduced last year to renew the benefits, increase payments, and expand the geographical areas covered by the law. Nez says the reauthorization is crucial for calculating how much radiation exposure was endured by former uranium mine, mill, and transportation workers, many of whom are tribal members. While Navajo officials support the law's proposed expansion, they want Congress to go even further to include additional categories of uranium workers and more types of cancers and illnesses, and increase individual payments to at least $200,000. The federal government conducted nearly 200 atmospheric nuclear weapons tests between 1945 and 1962. Many residents in parts of Arizona, Utah, Nevada, and other states and tribal lands have developed lung, thyroid, and other forms of cancer, along with leukemia and other long-term conditions. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The top leader of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma discussed the tribe's legal fight against drug makers and distributors involving opioid claims. Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. testified Tuesday in a U.S. House subcommittee hearing titled The Opioid Crisis in Tribal Communities. Hoskin told lawmakers, for more than two decades, opioids have impacted the tribe's economy, health services, schools, and families. He says hundreds of millions of pills have flooded the reservation, and the tribe is holding pharmaceutical companies accountable for contributing to the opioid crisis. 5 years ago, the Cherokee Nation sued drug makers and distributors. In 2021, the tribe settled with three distributors for $75 million. And earlier this year, a settlement was reached with Johnson & Johnson for $18 million. Claims remain pending against pharmacy chains. Hoskin says settlement money will help increase investments in mental health treatment and substance use disorder.
My administration plans to put $15 million of our settlement dollars towards the construction of drug treatment facilities over the next 3 years, a minimum of $15 million. These treatment centers will help bring about transformational change and provide some measure of justice by bringing healing to our people using funds from the very industry that injured us.
Hoskin says the settlements will not be enough to end the opioid crisis. He says the federal government needs to fulfill its trust obligations to tribes and fully fund these types of recovery programs. The hearing was held in the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. Other witnesses were from tribal health organizations and the National Border Patrol Council. The Alaska Federation of Natives is expressing gratitude to U.S. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski for backing U.S. Supreme Court nominee Federal Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. This week, Murkowski said she will support the confirmation of Brown Jackson after holding a series of meetings with the nominee. The Alaska Federation of Natives Tuesday thanked Murkowski for her commitment to the federal judicial nomination process. Native organizations and tribes have been closely following the confirmation process, stressing the need for the next justice to uphold sovereignty, treaty rights, and federal trust responsibilities. Brown Jackson did express knowledge of tribes during her confirmation hearing. She's expected to be confirmed this week. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Oklahoma's governor is expected to soon sign the country's strictest anti-abortion bill. Yesterday, the Oklahoma House of Representatives voted 70-14 to approve Senate Bill 612, which would imprison for 10 years health care providers who perform abortions at any time, quote, except to save the life of a pregnant woman in medical emergency, or fine them $100,000. With the passage of Texas's strict anti-abortion law last year, the number of abortions in Oklahoma has grown almost 2,500%, with about half of the abortions in that state performed for Texas residents. Tamia Cox-Turay, executive director of the ACLU of Oklahoma, said, quote, "We are actually going to be worse than Texas because this bill would prohibit abortion access at conception, whereas Texas allows for a six-week abortion ban. The Oklahoma law, like those in Texas and Idaho, gives no exception to cases of rape or incest." The U.S. Census Bureau reveals that as child nutrition policies expanded in response to COVID-19, food insecurity in households with children declined. Hunger-fighting groups in Ohio worry that once these policies expire, hunger will rise and food banks will be further strained. Mary Sherman has the story.
Federal pandemic waivers took a bite out of child hunger, according to census data, and there are concerns those trends could be reversed when the waivers expire in June. The policies improved access to school meals through universal free lunch, additional emergency funds for EBT cards, and by giving districts the flexibility to feed kids through mobile delivery and backpack programs. Catherine Unger with the Children's Defense Fund of Ohio says more meals were provided to more families during a time of significant need.
The end of these waivers in combination with the end of other supports that have helped families meet their basic needs is just going to put more strain on Ohio families' budgets. And this comes just at a time when we are met with rising food costs, rising gas prices.
Census data found food insecurity among financially insecure households with kids dropped 33% between April 2020 and July 2021. A new bipartisan Senate bill would extend the waivers for another year after lawmakers didn't do so in the most recent federal spending bill. Congress also failed to extend advanced child tax credit payments after December, which Kimberly Lovano with the Greater Cleveland Food Bank says helped families put food on the table.
Child tax credit was not designed to be a nutrition program, but that is simply what it became. About 60% of lower-income families used the benefit to purchase groceries, and more than 90% of families used the benefit to pay for things like utilities, rent, clothing, education.
Demand hasn't slowed at food banks and pantries in Ohio and is expected to pick up as inflation rises. Lovano adds they're not receiving the federal support needed in the wake of increased costs and supply chain issues. She calls it a perfect storm.
Without these waivers being extended and without Congress authorizing additional dollars for food banks to give out emergency food, we're just going to see a situation this summer where there just aren't as many resources for us to get food out, which really worries us.
President Joe Biden's fiscal year 2023 budget proposal calls for $519 million for the Emergency Food Assistance Program, $38 million more than last year. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Mary Sherman.
There's a lot of perceptions of doom going on, and some young adults are worried about having kids. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on that with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Some young adults say they're thinking twice about having kids because of climate change.
This is a very serious consideration that a lot of young people have. A lot of them worry about the state of the climate and the environment to the extent that it does affect their reproductive decisions.
Sabrina Helm of the University of Arizona and co-researchers in New Zealand conducted in-depth interviews with 24 young adults from both countries. They asked them about climate change and their thoughts about having children. Helm says some common themes emerged. Some participants expressed concern that having children will contribute to resource depletion and carbon pollution. And several expressed reluctance to bring children into a world transformed by global warming.
There's a lot of perceptions of doom going on.
But others feel that they can prepare their children.
Some expressed that they would educate their children in a way that they would be able to cope with hardship that is to come.
Ultimately, people's reproductive decisions are informed by many factors. But the interviews underscore that for some young people, climate change is not just a scientific concern. It affects how they think about their lives and futures. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael was not surprised.
As if torture and mass killings don't happen anymore, or at least not where people can see. As if Putin's formative years weren't spent rising in the ranks of the secret police. Only the tip of the atrocities have been found. Once a war starts, there are no civilians. Kill before they kill you. What's next? Biological weapons? Chemical? Nuclear? People around the world being killed every day because of their religion, their ethnicity, because they won't give up what they have, because they won't live like slaves. Prisoners in Guantanamo don't want to be transferred to American prisons because they fear conditions will be worse than Guantanamo. How do we start stopping the viciousness, the killing to intimidate and terrify? Cutting the defense budget would be good. Putting care, understanding, resources, and hope to the forefront. Headlines about people being rescued, being fed and sheltered. That would be news. Gun deaths and mass shootings are no longer news, just ways of making us fearful and unstable. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 6th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, Nadia Ramlagan, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Sojourner Truth Radio. At 9, hear Fight the Empire. At 10, it's American Standoff with host Jacqueline Keeler. Then at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk. Hosts will be interviewing author Charlotte Watson Sherman about her new children's book, Mermaid Kenzie, Protector of the Deeps. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. This evening, we're speaking with Piper McDaniel, an investigative reporter for Street Roots. They've taken on two new ambitious reporting projects focused on housing, instability, displacement, and holding the city accountable. Today, I'll be talking to Piper about one of these, the Renters' Rights Project. Let's get into it. Street Roots has taken on some really interesting reporting projects, and one of them is the Renters' Rights Project that you're helping to collaborate with, as I understand it. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of what that looks like?
So the Renters' Rights Project is zeroing in on housing security in Oregon. So we're launching this project, and it's going to be examining the impacts of housing security on people's lives with a particular focus on investigative reporting. And the context is that right now there's really pronounced housing insecurity, so it's been exacerbated by the pandemic, but there's other factors too, and it is a continually worsening problem. And in general, the existing homeownership system tends to favor the wealthy. So the net result of policy and the way that our like money and housing systems work is that power and money in relation to housing are concentrated in a small portion of the population. So this translates to displacement, eviction, and homelessness for people who have less money. And so this project is going to be looking at that and reporting on rapidly changing housing equity. And part of this will be an engagement journalism project. So we are inviting Multnomah County residents who are experiencing housing instability to sign up and receive periodic information, reader call outs, and surveys that are designed to gather information about their experiences. Or sometimes we will be doing call outs and asking people to, you know, tell us what they want to know about or things that we should be reporting on. And then there will be a final part of the project that is disseminating information about renters' rights to the public. That will be unveiled in a couple of months, but right now there is still information compiled on the Renters' Rights Project website, so you can find that at streetroots.org. So it's the Renters' Rights Project, and there is a clearinghouse of different resources for renters, and so it's information on ways to get housing subsidies or tenants' unions or just lists of like renters' rights if they're facing eviction, things like that.
How do you define housing instability?
Yeah, that has varying definitions. The general common meaning is housing instability refers to housing when people are experiencing housing that isn't stable or secure. So it would be instances where people have a hard time paying rent, can't pay rent, maybe where they're spending more than half of their income on housing, people who have to move frequently or get displaced, people living in overcrowded conditions or doubling up with friends and relatives. It can look like different things, but what's important is that it's prevalent and becoming more so. So there's lots of people here in Oregon who are at risk, and it's a situation